We've all heard stories of service dogs assisting the visually impaired, conducting search and rescue in disaster zones, and dogs used to detect drugs and bombs at airports. Yet few stories have been told about the Dogs for Defense program that was set up during World War II when the military did not have enough trained dogs for service. The program asked dog owners to volunteer their pets for military service, and many did. Susan Wilson's new book, A Man of His Own, is a fictional account of one of those remarkable dogs and the story about the special bonds that develop among the humans who love them and are faced with the challenges of life after war. Susan Wilson joins us in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program, Susan.
Well, thank you, Mindy. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is your third book that incorporates a dog as one of the main characters. I'm going to ask you more about that in a moment. But first, how did you first hear about the Dogs for Defense program, and why did you want to incorporate that into one of your novels?
Oh, good question. I encountered the Dogs for Defense when I was doing... the story was going to be a completely different book, let's put it that way, as they often are. They start off one way. And I did want to do something about military dogs because at the time, I mean, we see them on TV and we hear about them and, you know, the Navy SEAL dogs and all of that. And I began to actually do research on dogs in Afghanistan and all that. And somewhere along the line, serendipitously, I encountered this Dogs for Defense, and it blew me away. Mm. It really did. And I think part of the interest in it was the idea that people donated their pets.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're a dog owner or
dog
parent, as we like to call ourselves now, but the idea of sending
your dog to war.
I mean, granted, people send their children to war,
right,
but at least there's an intellectual choice there. But these people were doing this, and
right,
it just fascinated me. And so I knew that that had to be part, really a strong part of the story.
Right. And of course, nowadays, we have dogs specifically bred for this, and they spend years in training. This is, you know, just as the police dogs, they're bred for this. So it is. It's amazing to think of sending house pets after 12 weeks of training, sending them off to war. What were some of the tasks that the dogs performed?
They actually were broken down into groups. They had sentry dogs, who obviously were guard dogs. They had scout dogs, which is what my dog character becomes. They had dogs that acted as messenger dogs. They had dogs that were known as casualty dogs, which I really almost changed PAX into one of those because I think they were the most interesting. Their job was to go out and locate living casualties, not like cadaver dogs do now, but they would go out and they carried what they called a brinzel around their necks, and the wounded soldier would put that in the dog's mouth and the dog would go back and alert people that he had a live one.
That's
how they found them.
So after the war, the dogs are deprogrammed and returned to their owners. So what do we know about this deprogramming?
Well, I don't know as much about that. I do know that the dogs that were wanted by their owners. Now, some owners, and this was, you know, coming out of the Depression, it was a war. Some of these dogs were sent with the idea that they're good riddance, you know, we're gone. But most were retrained, less reprogramming than retraining. And I'm not sure exactly how it was accomplished, but I think what they just desensitized them from the thing that they had taught them, which was aggression, and then they turned it around.
And of course, your dog is a German Shepherd, and that's an aggressive breed to begin with.
It is considered an aggressive breed. I always get into trouble when, you know, fanciers of different kinds of breeds. Now, my first dog book was about a pit bull, and I learned a great deal about using inflammatory words. But a German Shepherd certainly is known for his demeanor.
Yeah.
But I think that they're also fiercely loyal dogs.
Boy, is that for
sure. Again, and one of the things that when I chose that breed in particular, he's not a full German Shepherd, by the way, is the idea of the divided loyalties. Mm-hmm. Now, we have a dog that is enormously loyal to his man, who then gets married, and so then the dog learns to be loyal to the wife, accepts her eventually as part of the pack, and then is taken from his home.
Right.
And he does not know why. You can't explain it to him. He's put in a crate. He's shipped off. And he really is heartbroken and becomes aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And along comes a man who's a lot like him. He's had a tough life. He's an orphan. He has no one. He also needs to connect. And he becomes his handler, and and again, in in the canyons of war, they become devoted to each other. Yeah. So now you have a love triangle.
You certainly do, yeah. So the story in your book, A Man of His Own, centers around Pax, which is this German Shepherd mix, who's volunteered into the Dogs for Defense program by Francesca after Rick, her husband, and really the original owner of Pax, goes off to war.
Yes.
And Pax and Rick both return from war. They weren't together, but Rick is now a paraplegic, and Pax, as you have mentioned, has this strong bond with his military handler, Keller. So perhaps you can fill us in a few more details of what happened next for our listeners so I don't give away the whole storyline.
Ooh, let me do it, huh?
You can do the teaser.
I can do the teaser. Well, essentially, as I said, there is a love triangle. I mean, we have Francesca and Rick, who are devoted to each other, and to Pax, and then we have Keller and Pax and Francesca and Rick. And so the participants, if you will, come to live together, which is, I guess it's not giving anything away. Keller does not want to return Pax, but he's an honorable man, and he asks that he bring the dog back, which would be unusual. Mm-hmm. Usually the dogs would be picked up by the owner or shipped, but, you know, literary license. and they can see how desperate how fond he is of the dog, and they can see the dog really is attached to him as well. But because of Rick's wounds, he needs care, and Francesca's been struggling with it. And he comes up with the idea of offering Keller a job as a live-in aide. And Keller has no place to go. He has no family. He does not know what he'll be doing for the rest of his life. He's been successful in the service because it took him out of a bad situation. He says, sure, why not?
Yeah. So here you have the three people that this dog has bonded with, like you say, the love triangle, the three of them in the same household, and all kinds of things can happen.
All kinds of things
do
happen. But it's the point person or the point creature is Pax, because he has to react to all of them.
Yeah. All right. So that's something that's interesting, too, about this book, is that we are hearing things from Pax's point of view. So describe why you wanted to tell the story from the perspective of Pax.
Well, it's sort of a signature, if you will, with my books, the ones that have been involved, where dogs have been the main characters or the secondary characters. And it's sort of a dog's eye view of things. And part of it is, well, really just sort of a tool in the toolbox, the writer's toolbox, is to gain a different perspective outside of the main character action. What's going on? Well, what does the dog think about this? And how? And it moves the story along in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But also, I think we all do it. We look at our dogs, well, what are you thinking?
What are you thinking?
What are you thinking about this? Now, don't think you can do that. And, you know, we do that for ourselves.
Yeah.
We anthropomorphize them. And I thought, it's a lot of fun to write from a dog's point of view. Now, I didn't give him, he is in third person.
Right.
And that...
Okay, he's not a talking dog.
He's not a talking dog. You know, I've done thinking dogs. And I do try to really try to get a sense of what a dog would really think. I don't want to make a cartoon character out of them. I want them to really be a functioning character without being... just not believable.
Right. Well, I think that when you set the scene in the beginning, you know, where we sort of, Pax comes into the world, so to speak, that read very real. You know, the poor little thing is, you know, it's tough times. Yeah. Mom's having a tough time, and he's left there in the little alleyway. And when he encounters Rick for the first time, that kind of introduction at first, I went, oh, no, what's he doing to that dog? But then you hear Rick's side of what's happening. And yeah, it's interesting to see the two perspectives as their very
fun.
First meeting.
It builds a whole character.
Exactly. So you've written a number of books, as we mentioned, focused on the dynamics of human relationships. And we've got the dog in the mix here. Dogs have had starring roles of two of your other books. So why dogs? And what's been the response?
Ooh, well.
There's a lot of dog lovers out there.
There are. And I will say, kind of to answer the second part of that, the response is phenomenal. I have been overwhelmed by the outpouring of messages from people who have read these books and who have said, oh, I couldn't, I cried. My dog is just like that. I can picture this. What it does, it resonates with people who are open to the idea of dogs as life partners. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't mean that in, you know, as opposed to a substitute for you know, family, but just are so dedicated to their animals and how important these animals are to people. Mm-hmm. And so the response has been overwhelming. I mean, I've just...
So you're obviously a dog lover yourself.
I'm a dog person. I would, I would definitely say that. But to go back to the first part of that, why dogs, is actually, I have to toss that back at my wonderful agent. We were bouncing ideas around, story ideas around, and I had written something that was just going nowhere, and I was about ready to, you know, throw in the towel, and it was a long, dry period. And apropos of nothing, she said, you know, dog stories are really popular now. Now, this was just after Garth Stein's mm-hmm. Magnificent, The Art of Raising in the Rain. And I thought, dog stories? I can do that. Mm-hmm. I grew up reading dog stories. I was completely, I mean, going to my little fourth grade, you know, elementary school library, and if it had a dog story, that was my book.
It, yeah.
I read them all. I read everything Albert Payson Terhune ever wrote about collies, which was my original breed of choice. Everything from Old Yeller to, you know, White Fang to, you name it, it was obscure. Baba, Son of Battle. I read them all. And so when Andrea said, dogs are... That's popular.
Little light bulb.
Wow, the light bulb went off. And I thought, that I can do.
Yeah.
And even now, you know, I'm working on something else and I can kind of hear Albert Payson's Terhune's voice in my background. Not like that.
Yeah, guiding you along.
Guarding me.
Yeah.
But it's been great. Yeah. It really has.
So as you mentioned, Keller stays on as an aide for mm-hmm. Rick, but Pax also takes on many of those duties, in essence, continuing his role mm-hmm. as a service animal. What kind of research did you do to determine the kinds of tasks that Pax could perform to someone who's in a wheelchair?
Well, I've had certainly correspondence with people who have had these experiences. I've, you know, read enough articles and things like that. I can't think of anything specifically, mm-hmm. But I did have, enough observation of, mm-hmm. Things on television, you know, 60 Minutes or whatever would show these therapy dogs. And a lot of it was just, how would it work?
Mm-hmm.
I had to imagine how would it work, because this was a dog that was not trained for therapy. This was long before therapy dogs became part of the culture. So I had to kind of invent it from the ground up, because if it were based on actual training process, it wouldn't work.
Wouldn't seem real.
It didn't exist at the time. However, having said that, some of the dogs that came back from World War II who were not rehomed with their original families were taken into something called Dogs for Casualties or Dogs for something like that, where they were used in like VA hospitals and places like that, and they were given to the wounded.
So, did you looking back to the Dogs for Defense program? Mm-hmm. Did you look into what that experience was like for other people? You know, dogs returning. Did you have stories from other ones, or was it all?
It was all in my head. I'm not a wonderful researcher. That's mm-hmm. not something that I am. I should do more of. I will say that I did get the actual Army manual of training for the dogs, which was great. And I read through that. And a couple of other, there was a wonderful article, not article, a book, a pictorial book that I've used quite a bit mm-hmm. Just to see the posters and the advertising and the propaganda, mm-hmm. if you will, towards getting people to make mm. this contribution.
Mm.
But my research is usually from the skin of my teeth, or from the hip.
You mentioned earlier that you were looking at some of the dogs that went into Afghanistan mm-hmm. and some of the current military dogs. Had you set this story in current day, you would have had to do a whole lot more research, wouldn't you?
Oh, I would have. And that would make me actually a little nervous, because mm-hmm. I think that you really do have to be accurate when mm-hmm. you're dealing with something that's so upfront and mm-hmm. real and right now. I'm too much of a coward to do that. I prefer to make it up and hope people agree with it.
Yeah. Right in the beginning of the book, Rick is a happy, successful, fun individual. When he returns from the war, he's dealing with so much mm-hmm. physical and emotional turmoil. He's not the same person. Yeah. And you do an excellent job relating the onslaught of anger, guilt, and self-pity that overcomes a person newly disabled. Describe how you developed the character of Rick.
He started off when I began to write the book, he wasn't even alive. He was already dead. Not already dead. He doesn't die at the end of the book. And as I started to write the book, I realized that he needed to be more of a character. And the next thing I know, he was the main character. These things happen.
It happens, yeah.
I think it's just you have to think of how people are. Mm-hmm. And it's an instinctual kind of a writing, I think.
So you put yourself in his shoes.
I have to put myself in the shoes. How would I feel? I mean, obviously, we all know people who have had terrible things happen to them. And a lot of people just rise to the occasion and just fight it back and maintain their joie de vivre and all of that. But I thought, no, he was dealing with something more. Mm. And his ultimate, you know, the crux of his loss, which it was pretty major, you know, he lost his hopes and his goals for his baseball future. He was a baseball player, and he was on the verge of becoming wonderful, and then now there's no hope of ever doing that again, and he's bitter. He's bitter.
Yeah. And then Keller and Pax, as you mentioned, they're sort of the same. I mean, Keller is the human version of Pax, and that was intentional, I take it?
It was a little, yes, definitely. I like to try and make a whole character out of two halves. I guess that's the best way to describe it. And Pax obviously was raised well and, you know, was fairly spoiled and all that. And Keller is an orphan. Mm-hmm. In the 30s, it was not uncommon for people to, you know, bounce their kids from one family member to another. He ends up in reform school. He's taken out of reform school by this curmudgeonly, mean old uncle that he doesn't even know. And he's made to work for a living. And, you know, he really has nothing to hang his hat on as far as emotions until he meets Pax. Right. And then suddenly he has something to love and to be loved by.
So the majority of the book takes place between 1938 and 1947, the pre and post-World War II time period. And then the final chapters take place in 2008. So you don't write much in those intervening years. And I wondered if why, sort of leaves people saying, well, what happened in that? You know, you want to know a little bit more.
You do. And I always think that it's kind of nice to be a little ambiguous. You know, how far could you go?
Right.
And I think that pushing it up back, you know, to 2008, you realize that this is somebody's past. Mm-hmm. And people get beyond their problems. And, I mean, I could have written another whole 300 pages to, you know, how did they get all, you know, where they were. But then I thought, no, you don't really need to do that.
Yeah.
You don't need to do that. A good, you know, resounding epilogue is sometimes enough. Right. You want to leave them thinking about them. You don't want to have everything tied
that's
up
true.
In a package.
Yeah, that's true. You want to have them lingering in your mind for a few days after you read it.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that you're working on your next book. Mm-hmm. Does it involve a dog?
Of course. It's called Sticking with a Good Thing. No, I've been encouraged this way. I have a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful editor, Jen Enderlin, at St. Martin's, and she has been really the power behind it and my cheerleader and also my taskmistress in many ways. And she has really said, you know, we want you to do more of this. And this will be the fourth. And at this point, I think I probably have run the gamut. But but people keep liking them.
What time period is the next book taking place?
This one that I'm doing now is current time.
Current time.
And it's a little different. But then it's only 65 pages in.
So who knows what could happen?
Who knows what could happen?
That character you didn't think was going to make a showing is now going to be the lead.
Somebody's out in the background saying, but me.
The book is A Man of His Own. Susan Wilson, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
You're listening to The Point. Joining us now, Elaine Lomenzo, a volunteer puppy raiser with Canine Companions, which is a nonprofit organization that provides highly trained assistance dogs to adults and children with disabilities. Puppy raiser, tell us, what is a puppy raiser?
Well, where do I begin? A puppy raiser is someone who volunteers to take into their home for a period of a year to 18 months. To nurture and train in obedience and manners, and at the end of that time, give it up to the organization to continue their training with him.
And when we hear the term service dogs, many of us think of dogs trained to work with the visually impaired, but Canine Companions dogs are used to assist humans in other ways. You have facilitator dogs, skilled companion dogs, hearing dogs, and assistance dogs. So let's talk about each of these. Let's start with assistance dogs.
That's sort of a catch-all phrase mm-hmm. for what these dogs do. And in fact, visual impairment is the one disability that this organization does not deal with. Mm-hmm. But so assistance dogs, someone in a wheelchair, someone who needs help with everyday tasks, opening doors, picking things up off the ground, turning off lights. Mm. These dogs are really pretty incredible.
Yeah. And hearing dogs.
Yeah.
That's for someone who can't hear, is either deaf or partially, but they mm-hmm. can tell you when
if
somebody's
the doorbell
at the door.
Is ringing, right. If your phone is going off, if an alarm, fire alarm. Yeah.
Yeah. And then these companion dogs, skilled companion dogs. What is that? Just I'm thinking, is it, veterans that need?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. In fact, the organization, one of their new initiatives is the Wounded Veterans Initiative, in which they are matching dogs with veterans coming home from Afghanistan mm-hmm. and Iraq with all kinds of, emotional and physical right. disorders.
Now, we always think of these dogs, going to the person who, has the disability or the need. But you also have something called facilitator dogs, where the guidance is coming from somebody else?
No, I think what that refers to are dogs who go into facilities. Who hospitals, for instance. Or in fact, there was a story right after the Boston Marathon bombings about one of our dogs who went in to visit mm-hmm. the victims right. in the hospital.
And but do you have situations where you would have somebody else sort of being the, I don't want to say master, but the person in charge of the dog? I'm thinking you might have somebody who has Down syndrome or muscular dystrophy or something mm-hmm. that's a little more debilitating mm-hmm. that would make it really hard for them to care for the dog.
Right. And in those cases, sometimes you do have a third person involved who helps with that task.
All right. Mm-hmm. So how did you get involved?
Oh, well, I have this dear friend, Susan Lee Vick is her name, and we've been friends since our single days in California. And I like to say that she, over the years, has talked me into many things. getting married, having children, natural childbirth, homeschooling, and this is only her latest idea. So she, a couple of years ago, became Canine Companion's National Director of Advancement. Mm-hmm. And so she called me last year and she said, okay, I'm raising a puppy and you're doing it with me.
Oh, boy.
And she lives in California. She said, let's do it. We raised our children together. Let's raise these puppies together. So she talked me into it, and then I had a little bit of a tougher time talking my husband into it.
Oh, let's hear that story then. So he said, I don't think so.
He said, we are empty nesters. Our second child had just gone off to college last year. And we had one dog, a 10-year-old dog. And he said, that's it. That's it for animals. I don't want to be tied down. What if we want to travel? And of course, I had an answer for everything. Everything.
You were prepared.
I was so prepared. And actually, the answer to the thing, his question about what if we want to travel, is that the organization has volunteers who will puppy sit for you because they realize that this is a commitment and that, that people will want to get away. And so still, no. We are not getting a dog, and the fist pounding on the desk in the office. And I finally told him about the Wounded Warriors Initiative. And my husband, Peter, is a Vietnam veteran.
And so that's, he said, okay, I'm on
said,
board.
What's that about? And I said, well, and he is very emotional about it because he, as he says, he came back from Vietnam in one piece mm-hmm. and many of his comrades did not. So that really touched his heart and he's been overboard on this ever since.
So when you told him about the Wounded Warrior piece, what did you tell him? Did you tell him, what these dogs do?
So I had already been telling him about how incredible these dogs were because I went to a demonstration in New York with my friend Susan and actually watched these dogs in action. And then I attended a training program at the facility in New York, which is our closest regional offices on Long Island. And I saw these dogs being trained and the things they can do. It was mm-hmm. amazing. Yeah. So I had been telling Peter about that. And then I said, so, picture a soldier coming back from Iraq, mm-hmm. Having lost a limb or two and has this dog in their life who can help them live an independent life.
Well, not only that, but anybody who's a dog owner, mm-hmm. There's just something about that relationship. You look into their eyes, it's that mm-hmm. kind of unconditional love mm-hmm. that, you feel like, They look, they see right into your soul.
Yes.
I think they do.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they do. Yeah.
They know what's going on. They just have this intuition about us, which, you know, you can see that that bond would be so important.
Yes. To someone who has been through what they've been through.
Right. Exactly. If you have had an experience with a service or therapy dog, we'd love to hear about your experience. Or if maybe you have a question about becoming a volunteer puppy raiser, give us a call. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right. So I know that you're the puppy raiser part, but do you know much about how the dogs are trained after they leave you?
Only in that I did attend a bit of a training session back in the last winter when I was considering this. And I went to the facility on Long Island, and it's about 6 months of training, intensive training of these dogs. And they are taught 40 to 50 commands in that 6 months. And it's really quite a remarkable process. So they train these dogs, and at the end, I think I want to say 3 or 4 times a year, they gather together a group of, say, 15 people who want dogs and who have been on a waiting list, and 16 or 17 dogs, and they bring them together for 2 weeks. Mm. And and I found this so fascinating. The first 3 days, you can't walk in as a person who has asked for a dog. You can't walk in and say, oh, I really love that chocolate lab. He's so cute. It doesn't work that way. So for the first 3 days that the people and the dogs are together, the staff watches them and watches the interaction among them all. And so at the end of 3 days, everyone gathers and the staff will say, you know, Mindy, we noticed that you and Fiore really connected, that he gets your sense of humor and you enjoy his playfulness, or, you know, whatever. And we think you would be a good team. And then that's a team. And then they do that with each of the people. And then for the next, 10 days, they live together in the dorms on the facility. And they learn how to work and live together. Mm-hmm. And the dog lives in the room with the person. And then they spend their days learning how to
Can see if the staff has made the right choice.
I understand that it's rare that they haven't.
Yeah. I suppose that's a good way to do it, because then that way you're not getting home and then going, oh, what do I do now? And, you know, maybe this wasn't the right dog for me. So if you have any, you know, hesitations or questions or issues, that's the time that you can.
And then they have what's called graduation. And here's the thing. So as a puppy raiser, and my darling Riesling is our puppy, if he makes it through the program, and by the way, only 40% of the dogs do.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, that's incredible. So say he makes it through the program and he is matched with a person. We, as his puppy raisers, get to hand the leash over at graduation to the person who gets it.
So what happens to those puppies who don't make it?
Good question. So from what I understand, because they are so highly trained, they can't just release them back to us as a pet. Well, we might get them because they offer them to another assistance dog program, and then I believe to law enforcement, and then we get a chance to have him back. Yeah.
So if he happens to be a mischievous, you might actually get him back.
That's right. Although he's so handsome, my husband is fond of saying that if he doesn't make it in this program, he'll go straight to Hollywood because he is quite a good-looking boy.
All right, so let's talk about the breeds that you use.
Yes. So Canine Companions for Independence has their breeding facility is in the national headquarters out in Santa Rosa, California. And that's where all the breeding takes place. And they breed purebred labs, purebred golden retrievers, or a mix of the two. Mm-hmm. And they have determined that these are the breeds that are most appropriate for the kind of assistance that they
So what are the specific traits then that make them better than other breeds?
I'm not sure because I'm not I'm not in that area, and I don't know. You know, I would say gentleness, intelligence.
They're pretty smart.
Just their temperaments are so lovely.
Mm-hmm, yeah, you sort of touched on this, but as you mentioned, one of the Canine Companion Facilitator dogs, Wenna? Is that how they say it?
Yes.
Was invited by Boston Medical Center to visit the victims of the Boston bombings for several days following the tragedy. Describe the reaction that trauma victims have when a dog like Wenna is brought in. And what is their role? What are they trained to do?
I have never actually witnessed it, and I did not, unfortunately, get to witness that. But from what I understand, it's just a calming effect that these dogs had. And you talked earlier about the affection and the just that way that dogs are with people. And, you know, I guess it's just something to touch. And,
So and when I guess also works with the Massachusetts criminal justice system, giving comfort to victims of violent crimes, particularly children. And I didn't realize this when, especially when children are giving testimony against their attackers. And you can almost see that. You can see where kind of just hanging on and petting that dog would help. So I guess they're just bred to kind of in that situation just be there.
Just be there and be a comfort.
A comfort. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. What's your experience with a service or therapy dog? We'd love to hear from you. 866-999-4626. Or if you have questions about becoming a puppy trainer, you are the only puppy trainer on the Cape?
Well, and it's not really a trainer. I'm
a puppy raiser. I'm sorry, puppy raiser,
For this organization, So a big part of why we're doing this is to hopefully attract other puppy raisers. And the example I give is that suppose you are you were a victim of the Boston Marathon bombings and you have lost a limb or two, and you call Canine Companions for Independence and you say, I think I'd like to have a service dog, and you make it through their process, and they will promise you a dog within 2 years.
That's
when
a long
time. Fact you want that dog today. Right. And the reason is that they do not have enough people doing what we are doing, being puppy raisers, because people think it's too hard. And I'm here to tell you, it is a joy.
I think that's too part of maybe that's why they choose the breed, because these puppies, they're really very well behaved puppies.
Oh my gosh. And we have never had a puppy.
Yeah.
This was a big undertaking for us. And if I had known it was going to be this easy, I'm not kidding. It's been a joy. It has not been a problem at all. We have loved, the entire family has loved every minute of it.
We're talking with Elaine Lomenzo, volunteer puppy raiser with Canine Companions. We'll find out how she feels about saying goodbye to this puppy when we come back from a break.
Lobsterman George Cadwallader from Woods Hole.
His name was Buck after a collie I had as a boy. Buck and the coyotes used to watch each other. They're very similar. He was a short-haired dog, short-haired border collie, long, kind of rangy build, and the local coyotes are built very much the same way. They're quite pretty animals. He was a border collie, and if anything he saw moving around, he had to herd it. If it didn't go where he wanted it to, he'd nip at it. He didn't mean any harm. He was a wonderful boat dog. He sometimes in the fog could spot my floats before I saw him. That was his station right there. His nose was like a radar. You just watch where he was looking, and chances are he had a pod. Actually, you could make a case for the fact that we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Buck. I was going across the Sound in a very thick fog, and there's a radar that normally sits here. And I had a big target on the radar, and all of a sudden, about half a mile out, it just disappeared. It just fell off the screen. And so I was sort of fiddling, trying to tune it back in. And all of a sudden, he began to bark, and I looked up, and right in front of me was this big dragger, had his flopper stoppers out, and the buck hadn't barked, it'd run us right over.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
And you're listening to The Point. We're talking with Elaine Lomenzo, a volunteer puppy raiser with Canine Companions, a nonprofit that provides highly trained assistance dogs to adults and children with disabilities. All right, you've got this beautiful puppy that you are bonding with and loving, and in next August or somewhere thereabouts, you're going to have to say goodbye?
So they tell me.
How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, we went into this knowing that that was the end result. It's not like someone's going to knock on our door and say, oh, we're taking your dog now. I mean, we knew going in that this was part of the deal. And, you know, check with me next August. But but the way we look at it right now is that we will give him up willingly because someone's waiting for him. Someone has been waiting maybe up to 2 years for him, someone who really needs him. And so that's why we're willing to, and in that regard, we can't give him up fast enough.
Right,
because someone deserves and needs him.
All right. How are they named?
So our dog's name is Riesling, like the wine.
Yeah.
And he is a beautiful yellow lab. He's almost 8 months old. And they name them, as you can imagine, they have litter after litter after litter out in Santa Rosa, California, and they name them alphabetically. So our Riesling was part of the R litter. My friend Susan's was part of the E litter, so she has Ethan. I have Riesling. But we particularly love it that Riesling was born in the wine country of California.
Very
and
nice.
So his name is very appropriate. But yeah, so they are named by the alphabet.
So as you're raising these puppies, and I know this is your first one, mm-hmm. are you keeping track of like personality traits and you know things that might define what role might be best suited for this dog?
Well, they do ask us to report in once a month mm-hmm. on how he's doing, how he's thriving, you know, his vet appointments, and any other anecdotes that we would like to provide. And so we would, you know, maybe say he's very playful, he's very trainable, mm-hmm. we think, you know, we think he's perfect in every way. Mm-hmm. But yes, they do ask you to do that. And then I don't know what they do with that information on the other end. Yeah. But
all right. So talk about the socialization for these puppies. This is very important. If these are going to be, you know, dogs that are, you know, out in the public and working with people, they must be socialized, right?
Yes. And in fact, a term that they use is that the dog should be bomb proof. Mm. Like literally, if your service dog is sitting next to you and a bomb goes off, they should not react without a command from you, from mm-hmm. Their person. But so they have to be used to a lot of different situations. So one of our main jobs is to socialize them, to bring them into public places. Riesling happens to be we own a real estate company, and he's in with us every day. Mm-hmm. So we bring him into the office. He is our mascot. He wears every time he's in public, he has on his vest, his Canine Companions for Independence vest.
Well, that's the thing. When you see a dog out and working like that, you know, your first reaction is go, oh, what a cute dog, and you want to pet him and all of that. That's not really a good idea, though, right? Because they're working. You should ask.
Well, Riesling isn't working yet,
okay,
but eventually he will be, and then you should ask the mm-hmm. person whose service dog he is.
Yeah.
But right now it's okay to touch him, and part of what we're trying to teach him is to sit and be calm when people right. do that, when people greet him.
So did you have to go through some training yourself then on how to train?
No, but they do like to approve, because we're the first puppy raisers on the Cape, mm-hmm. we did not have an approved puppy training facility in other parts of the country. They
do,
you know, trainers that do just canine mm-hmm. companions dogs. So they wanted to approve the person I chose, and I chose a woman by the name of Heather Gar, who's mm-hmm. terrific. And so I'm like any other puppy owner. I go to classes every Saturday morning for an hour and try to get him to heal, you know?
All right, so you have an event coming up this weekend where people can meet some of the dogs and see their skills in action. So tell us about this.
Yeah, this is terrific. This is we are one of 11 venues across the country holding some, what they're calling their signature national event, and it's called Dog Fest, mm-hmm. Walk and Roll. And it's terrific. So Cape Cod, the next closest one I think was on Long Island. Mm-hmm. But ours is this Saturday. It's in South Dennis at the Johnny Kelly Park from 1 to 4. And what it is I describe it as a dog-centric afternoon of family fun.
Yeah.
And so it's a fundraiser for Canine Companions.
And it's also an opportunity if you think this might be for you, if you know, think of, it's a puppy and it's going to, to help somebody's life, make a big difference
yes.
in somebody's life.
Yes, and Riesling will be there. Riesling will be there. I will give a little talk in the opening ceremony about why we got involved. And then we will have a team. There's one, what we call graduation team, only one on the Cape.
Wow.
And he lives in Sandwich. His name is Craig Bouts, and his dog is Fiore, part of the F litter that year. And they will be there to talk about specifically about how Fiore affects Craig's life.
Elaine Lomenzo, volunteer puppy raiser with Canine Companions. Thanks so much for coming in and letting us know about the organization. Hope you get some volunteers to raise more puppies here on
Thank
Cape
you
Cod.
So much, Mindy. It was my pleasure.